Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am swell.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Before we get started, quick reminder that Across the Movie Aisle Live is happening Tuesday, April 9th, 7 p.m. at the Bryant Street Alamo Drafthouse in Washington, D.C. We are showing and talking Arrival, the Denis Villeneuve movie. Tickets are going fast. I think there's about 40 left. Again, they're in that first two rows. But those are great seats. They're fun. You can sit there and crane your neck back. And you don't even have to crane it back because the seats recline very nicely. It's very comfortable. Come watch good movie. Meet some fellow Across the Movie Aisle fans. Say hi to us. Have a few beers at your table. It'll be fun. It's going to be a good time. All right, now on to controversies and non-controversies. Last week, Across the Movie Aisle favorite entertainment strategy guy put out an interesting newsletter at The Ankler suggesting that we, that is the collective we, the entertainment media we, are harder on the traditional movie studios than we are on the tech giants when it comes to streaming stuff, routinely ridiculing moves made by, say, Peacock or Warner Brothers while lauding or quietly ignoring the same moves or disasters made by streaming services owned by Apple, Amazon, and Netflix. Just a few examples here. So Peacock, a lot of people made fun of Peacock. They were the butt of jokes when they shelled out a ton of money for an NFL playoff game. You know, everybody setting the cancel service reminder buttons, you know, and then it turns out it led to millions of new subscribers and a 71% of those signups remained active 2+ months later, which means it's probably a win, right? It's still a loss leader for Peacock. It's still a money losing proposition, just 1-to-1. Hey, this is not going to pay for itself, but it got people to sign up for the service. They're sticking around. You saw knock-on effects like The Office popping up in the top 10 of the Nielsen streaming for the first time, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, Amazon, similarly, almost certainly lost money on their spate of Thursday night games, and there's no way Sunday Ticket made money for YouTube, but those are touted as big moves, big wins for the tech companies, which is, again, it's just kind of weird. Movies like The Marvels and The Flash were slammed as huge money losers for Disney Plus and WB, or Disney proper and WB, yet they earned far more money than something like Killers of the Flower Moon, which industry watchers have been slow to slam as a flop. They earned way more money than Napoleon. Or look at the world of streaming, where something like Secret Invasion, which is described as a huge disappointment for Disney+, people say it was just a massive, huge failure, did way bigger numbers than the similarly expensive Citadel on Amazon Prime. Now, Citadel hasn't been lauded as a huge win or anything for the streamer, but no one is really talking about it like the disaster it really is either. It's just kind of there. Most things are just kind of there. The most interesting divergence, and one I want to focus on here for a minute, is the treatment of WB's decision to kill Batgirl and Coyote versus Acme. We'll see if they still kill Coyote versus Acme. It's kind of in the works. But people lost their minds about it. Whereas Netflix decided to shelve Halle Berry's The Mothership. And you are probably sitting there saying, what's The Mothership? I don't even know what that is. And that's because you've never heard of it, because there wasn't a month-long freakout when Netflix decided to shelve it, unlike when Warner Brothers decided to shelve Batgirl and Coyote versus Acme. And I think this last one really gets to the heart of the matter, right? No one actually cares when a Netflix original gets shelved, because no one really considers Netflix originals to be art, really. Outside of the handful of Oscar bait movies they release between October and December every year, right? Netflix is a content factory, and nobody really cares when a widget doesn't make it off the manufacturing floor. WB, on the other hand, Warner Brothers, they are a movie studio, and movie studios make art, or at least art-adjacent commercial projects, which is, you know, why we all get a little more sensitive when they decide to shelve something. And then we can talk about fandoms and all that, and, you know, the role of that sort of thing here. But, you know, the real point here, and this is, I think, what the entertainment strategy guy is getting at, is spiking Batgirl and spiking Coyote versus Acme, these are convenient ways to bash David Zaslav, the much-hated head of Warner Brothers. And look, I get it. I don't like a lot of the moves that Warner Brothers has made. I don't like the way that HBO has been treated. I don't like the destruction of the HBO Max app, which it really is almost terrible to use now. It's very hard to look at that home screen. Just as a, you know, person who loves HBO and film, you go to that screen, it's like, well, one thing I want to watch and then 17 seasons of Dr. Pimple Pop or whatever. That's neither here nor there. And this loops back to the broader question. Why is it that the tech-based streamers seem to get a pass on this sort of thing while the studios are constantly taking it on the chin? Peter, is there a pro-tech streamer bias in the entertainment media, or is something else going on here?
I don't know if I would actually call it a pro-tech or streamer bias. It is much more to do with our sense of artistic justice. And it's just about the sort of widgets versus cinema, versus art dichotomy that you have already raised here. To the extent that there is a pro-tech bias, it's that tech is big and successful, and there's a, you know, that makes the big tech companies look like winners, and there is often in business journalism a pro-winners bias, right? And because they're big and they sort of, like, even if they lose a ton of money on something, they stay big and stay successful, they look like winners. Now, that's obviously not always true in all business journalism. There is, in fact, a large antagonistic strain, but to the extent that there are people who are writing about this sort of thing, I think, you know, we talk about fan communities around specific franchises or shows or IPs, but in the business world, there are fan communities around big tech companies. I think people actually are pretty aware of this phenomenon when it comes to Apple, but it's not just Apple either. There are sort of people who are like, yes, this company is dominating and I love it, and it's a sports game for them. And so it's like, yeah, they're buying a big thing and it's big. Good for them. Thumbs up. And I also think there is just a kind of a recognition of a real reality here. And the Entertainment Strategy Guy post that you reference, which is great, gets into this, which is those big tech companies do have a real advantage, just a sort of built-in advantage given their circumstances, which is that it's not that big a deal for them to lose a ton of money. And in some cases, it might even be strategically advantageous for them to lose a ton of money. And so it may be that because they are operating at a financial plane that other companies, including big movie studios, which, you know, bring in billions of dollars a year in revenue, even in bad years, it may be that the big tech companies are, in fact, doing something that is smart and savvy and good for their bottom lines and good for customers while losing money, that if a movie studio did the same thing, it would not be a good idea because the movie studio would be costing itself in some way that it can't afford. And so there, it may just be that there is a, that it is correct, at least partially, that when Apple does it, it's a, or Amazon does it, it's a good idea. And when Warner Brothers does it, maybe it's not such a good idea.
Yeah, Alyssa, I think that's a real issue here, right? Which is that tech is big, tech is successful. You know, the market cap for Apple is some absurd multiple of the market cap of all the movie studios combined.
Of like a bunch of countries.
I mean, yeah.
Like many countries don't have, their GDP is not Apple's market cap.
Right. We're talking about, you know, something on Apple. You know, let's say they spend $200 million on a foundation series that 37 people watch. Does it matter? Does it matter to Apple? No. But if HBO spent $200 million on a show 37 people watched, and they may have with Raised by Wolves, I don't know what the exact numbers on both sides of that equation are, but it's probably not far off that. Show I liked, by the way. I love Raised by Wolves, but I was one
at
of the rare ones.
At least two people on this podcast watched yeah. and liked Raised by Wolves. Weirdest show I've seen in a decade.
But, you know, that's the sort of thing where if you spend that sort of money and nobody watches it, nobody signs up for your service, then that does actually hurt Warner Brothers in a way that it cannot hurt Apple or Amazon or whatever else. So the question, I guess my question for you is fair even the right way to look at this? I mean, like, it's the Unforgiven line, right? Deserves got nothing to do with it.
Yeah. And what I was going to say is that I think the useful way to think about this is not in terms of whether the mainstream media is being fair or unfair. And I think that kind of charge is always just really complicated to parse. But I think rather we are operating in an information ecosystem that has been very successfully distorted by the non-traditional media companies who have entered the media market, right? I mean, there has been talk for years about how Netflix did not release useful information about the viewership of individual shows. And even now, the sort of minutes watched, you know, number of streams to completion, whatever, all of this stuff is kind of gobbledygook under the best of circumstances. And more importantly, it doesn't give us a framework for understanding what the success or failure of an individual project means to the company's bottom line, right? A subscription business is inherently a different business than a tickets, you know, unit sold business. A tech company that operates a movie studio as part of a large and diversified set of business operations is a very different entity than a company that just makes movies and television shows. And so, you know, if there is a sense that people are harder on traditional studios, traditional media companies, when they shelve products, when they, you know, make moves like sending something direct to streaming, it's because there exists a framework in business journalism and in media journalism for talking about what those moves mean. There is just no great way that I am aware of to talk about what, you know, the potential financial loss on Killers of the Flower Moon means to Apple's business strategy, right? And maybe the answer is that it means nothing, right? Maybe the tech companies are all just sort of playing with house money and, you know, producing stuff so Ted Sarandos can hang out with Meghan Markle in Montecito. You know, there is just not a conventional frame of reference for explaining what the success or failure of the individual products produced by tech-based media companies mean to those companies in the same way that there is to be able to say that, you know, David Zaslav has decided that Warner Brothers is making too much content and it's not good enough and he's going to shrink it down and take some tax losses, right? It's just, you know, by blowing up viewership metrics for streaming stuff, the streaming companies injected an enormous amount of uncertainty into the system. But the business metrics are also just different, and there is not a good way to talk about that. I do not particularly think this is the result of Homerism. I think it's just a apples to oranges situation that is not particularly easy to clarify for lay readers.
Or apple to oranges.
I think that, see, it's interesting, Alyssa, because I think that's both right and wrong. I mean, it's right in the sense, absolutely, that we don't know what a profit and loss model looks like for Apple TV Plus. We just don't, because we don't know how much money they're making, what they're even trying to do. We don't know what the actual goal is there. If it's to sell hardware that people use then to watch the software on, we don't know if it's just simple brand maintenance. We don't know what it is.
Is it fun, right? Like, is it fun to have so much money that you can, you know, make Martin Scorsese's dreams come true and make him happy? Maybe it's just fun.
And we don't know what the end goal with Amazon Prime is, right? We don't know what the goal with Prime Video is. If it's to integrate purchasing socks while you watch Jack Reacher, like, ooh, he's wearing a pair of darn tough hiking boot socks. That's great. I want to get the size 17 XL that he wears.
I mean, I think that's clearer. And, you know, obviously I say this is a wholly owned subsidiary of Jeff Bezos. But with Prime, the idea is to give more value to the Prime subscription that people pay every year, right? Like, it's, you know,
Amazon has data that shows that people buy a lot more stuff if they are Prime subscribers. So they are making the Prime subscription more valuable by adding features like music and movies and et cetera.
Absolutely. But quantifying all of this is very hard. Trying to figure out specifically like what Citadel does versus doesn't do for your, you know, entertainment dollar is very difficult. So, all right. So set that aside. I think that's basically right. The one place where I disagree with you in terms of specifically the discussion of fairness and how we talk about things is how we talked about the shelving of those movies, right? So, like, again, you've got this Halle Berry movie that nobody knows anything about, nobody really cares about. It's some Netflix original. If we see it, we don't see it. It doesn't matter. There is no set of fans there that's like, where's my Halle Berry content? I loved all the Halle Berry stuff. I want to watch more of it. And there's no, I mean, I assume someone is saying that somewhere. But it's not like DC or Marvel or Looney Tunes, right? But at the same time, you don't have the anguished think pieces where the writers for RogerEbert.com are sitting down and saying, people worked on these movies. They poured hours of their lives into them. This is a betrayal of the idea. You know, the whole movie business is built on taking risks. And sometimes you make a thing and it's bad. But you don't disrespect the people who made the blah, blah. We saw piece after piece like this when the Batgirl news came down and when the Coyote versus Acme news came down. We saw piece after piece like this. And we absolutely do not see that with Netflix. We do not see that with Netflix. And I don't think it's because writers, you know, have any special love for Netflix. I think if anything, the opposite is true. I think people are more willing to take shots at Netflix than any other studio, just in terms of like the actual stuff that they make. But I also think that the reason those pieces got written specifically about Warner Brothers and not Netflix is because, as the entertainment strategy guy kind of alluded to, people really wanted to take shots at David Zaslav. And like for good reason, frankly. That guy sucks. Whatever. Take shots at David Zaslav. But I do, there was a maybe I am just reading my own biases into this, but it felt like there was a very specific and intentional effort to target them for this sort of thing that simply does not happen anywhere else.
Wait, are you saying the journalists are bringing in their personal hobby horses into their supposedly neutral work?
I would never, but I hear it happens.
Okay, so two things. One, I am the only person on the planet who's extremely upset about the shelving of Coyote v. Acme because I love the New Yorker short story on which it's based. It's unbelievably hilarious, and we deserve the Ian Fraser cinematic universe. Two, don't you think, though, that that attitude towards Netflix and the streamers actually represents sort of a deep well of condescension towards them, right? Like, if it's a question of fairness, then there is sort of a fundamental presumption of unseriousness in the lack of attention paid to their slates and what they do about it.
I mean, I believe that there is an absolutely this art versus widget mentality. That's why I framed it that way. I really think that's a real thing. But I also, Peter, I mean, look, I do think it gives, if you hand people an extra brick to throw at David Zaslav, they're going to chuck it. They're going to rear back and throw it. And that doesn't, you just don't see it. You don't see the same sort of tone or attitudes, again, specifically on this issue with regard to the tech streamers when stuff gets canceled.
Zaslav makes for a good villain. There are a lot of people who don't like him. And I think some of those reasons are good. Some of those reasons are not as good. It's complicated. We could do a whole episode just on Zaslav. But the other thing, though, is sort of if you want to compare Zaslav's canceling of Batgirl or Coyote versus Acme to Mothership, there are two differences there that we should note and that I think are important. One is Coyote versus Acme and Batgirl both take place, popular existing IP. There are fans of Looney Tunes and there are fans of the Batman movies, right? And the Batverse characters. And the filmmakers, frankly, have fans. Mothership is not connected to anything except people who like Halle Berry. I don't even know who directed it. And I've read a couple of stories about this. But the other thing, so there's the IP difference. And that makes a big, that's a big divide, right? Because people fixate on, I want to see more Batman stuff in a way that they don't fixate on, I want to see another weird science fiction movie from Netflix that is probably, I will forget 2 hours after I see it. But the other thing is that the Mothership news came afterwards. And there's, like, to some extent, exhaustion gets burned out on these things, right? So it was Batgirl first, and then Coyote versus Acme, and then Mothership. And in the order there, by the time Mothership was canceled, it's just another movie being canceled for tax reasons. And like, to some extent, how many times can you write that story?
Maybe Netflix has better PR people.
I think it's fair to say they have better PR people than David Zaslav personally. That's for sure. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy? This is that the studios are treated more harshly by observers than the tech streamers. Peter.
I don't think it's actually a controversy that people who are invested in movies as an art form are very focused on the movie studios. Maybe those people should be equally focused on large tech companies, but it's just not at all surprising to me that they reserve more passion, whether it's positive or negative, for the companies that are devoted primarily to making movies.
Alyssa.
It's a controversy.
I think it's a mild controversy. I do think that there should be more equity in the brick bat swinging. I think in the media, take it to the give the studios a little more credit. They're trying real hard, folks. They got a tough. They've been dealt a tough hand.
Aww.
They're up against these bottomless pockets of the tech giants. They got to make things happen for the rest of us. Make good things for the rest of us. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our bonus episode on Friday, in which we're going to offer up some pitches for Hollywood in the wake of the blockbuster success of Godzilla v. Kong and those movies. What franchise face-off should the studios pursue next? We got some pretty crazy ideas. You're not going to want to miss them. Things are going to get silly. I got a feeling things are going to get very silly. We'll see. Speaking of the big lizard and the big monkey, on to the main event. Godzilla Kong, the new empire. That's right. The X in the title is silent for some reason. It's not Godzilla X Kong or Godzilla times Kong. It's just Godzilla Kong, the new empire. News you can use. You don't want to sound like a fool when you mention Godzilla Kong, the new empire, to your friends, do you? As the film begins, Kong lives below us in Hollow Earth. He's searching for more Kongs. He wants more Kongs to play with. Godzilla lives on the surface, occasionally fighting massive kaijus and leveling cities in the process. After taking out one big fella, he curls up for a nap in the Colosseum, much to the chagrin of Italian authorities who were told they could shut up about it. Just shut up, Italy. You can't do nothing about Godzilla. That's what you can do. On the human side of things,
I just tell you you're going to give this movie a thumbs up because somebody said shut up to the Italians.
You love to see it. On the human side of things, Eileen Andrews, who's played by Rebecca Hall, is trying to figure out why her ward Gia, who's played by Kaylee Hoddle, is seeing and drawing weird spikes of electromagnetic energy. It's the thing kids do. You get used to it. She's also reconnecting with Trapper, who's played by Dan Stevens, a veterinarian who replaces Kong's impacted tooth with a titanium crown. And conspiracy podcaster Bernie, who's played by Brian Tyree Henry, who just wants everyone to believe him. He was there. He helped. He helped save the world from Mechagodzilla. Just believe him, man. He just wants some credit. And now, look, I could describe the plot of this movie in detail, probably. It involves Kong finding more Kongs in an even hollower Earth. And then one of the Kongs is an evil Kong, and he rides an ice Godzilla, and he wants to come to the surface and conquer the Earth. That's the plot of the movie. But it would be kind of pointless, because this movie is aggressively dumb. And what I admire about the dumbness of it is that it doesn't hide from its dumbness. It doesn't make excuses for the dumbness. It doesn't even really wink at the dumbness. It's not like you got somebody off screen saying, oh, well, that just happened 17 times a minute. Maybe it happens once or twice, but it doesn't happen that much. This is a movie where King Kong throws sand in Godzilla's eyes right before perfectly suplexing him into the desert next to the Giza pyramids. And then the evil King Kong, again, he rides up on his ice Godzilla to do battle. And then earlier in the film, King Kong picks up Baby Kong and uses Baby Kong as a club against the other clubs. He's just swinging Baby Kong around. This isn't in my script. I'm going off script here for a second. I was going to take my kids to see this movie, but I think seeing the violence done to Baby Kong in those opening minutes would send him screaming from the theater. I don't think he'd be able to handle it. Poor Baby Kong. Luckily, they make amends by film's end. To get worked up about the mechanics of how any of this works, like of how Mothra comes back to life to save the day, it just feels beside the point. Again, the movie never shies away from its dumbness. And that's why I'm a little bit torn on it, because yes, it is objectively one of the stupidest things I've ever watched on a large screen. But it leans into the dumbness in a way that I kind of admire. It reminds me of Independence Day in a way. Independence Day, really dumb movie, but so much fun. I love that movie. Also, I just really enjoy watching Dan Stevens. His turn as the gonzo giant animal doctor. I've been watching his FX show Legion recently. It's been my gym show. I just watch it while I'm on the elliptical or whatever. And he has this like kind of fantastically twitchy manic energy, and like also just like fairly standard movie star good looks, right? Good for him. He's a good looking guy. I'm not entirely sure why he hasn't hit that top tier of movie stardom. Hopefully the $80 million opening here nudges him toward it. The problem with this movie, and the reason I can't really give it the full thumbs up despite being fine with the dumbness of it, is that the monster on monster action is, I regret to say, kind of, you know, typical weightless CGI nonsense. It's video game cutscenes. Outside of that wonderful professional wrestling bit I mentioned earlier, nearly every fight takes place either in the Hollow Earth, which kills our sense of scale because, like, I don't know what any of this stuff is supposed to look like, or more weirdly, out of sight and underwater. Like, two distinct fights take place underwater and are finished underwater. We don't actually see what happens. Part of this is probably the budget, right? This movie costs just in scare quotes there, $130 million, making it relatively cheap for this sort of thing. Or maybe it's a simple misunderstanding of how to use these monsters. Whatever it is, it makes everything kind of blah. And that is ultimately why the movie fails. Unfortunately, it does fail. As much as I enjoy Kong basically playing, you know, either Riggs or Murtaugh, one of them, he's just getting too old for this shit, man. He just wants to take a shower. He wants to eat a sandwich. His tooth hurts. He's got a toothache. He just wants to go to the dentist and have some somebody pull out his tooth. It doesn't inspire awe. It's goofy and it's fun, but it's not awe-inspiring. Godzilla Minus One, which I think we all saw, maybe. I don't think we did an episode on it. I can't remember anything now. My brain is mush. I saw Godzilla Kong, The New Empire. Godzilla Minus One inspired awe, right? The Gareth Edwards Godzilla inspired awe. Even Kong Skull Island had a little awe in it. This movie, aweless. It's no awe. There's minus awe in it. It's Godzilla Minus Awe. Take that. I want to be awed, damn it. Alyssa, what did you make of Godzilla Not X Kong, The New Empire?
So I did not take my children to see Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire, because as my daughter put it, it's scary. The giant dragon turns into a giant bear. My two-year-old seemed more interested.
Accurate.
He told Sonny and Peter after last week's podcast, I like the bear, but I think he was mostly trying to be cool. I did not particularly enjoy this movie. Like, it's very dumb, and I can sort of get how the dumbness would be amusing, but it was not to me. I didn't care. And I think for dumbness to be enjoyable, it has to be sort of transcendently dumb. To talk about it, just a very different movie. The original Anchorman is dumb a lot of the time. Like, it's a sort of purposefully dumb movie. Like, you know, that, like, Steve Carell just sitting there and saying totally sincerely, I love Lamp, is incredibly stupid, right? But there is sort of the dumbness, it's so dumb that it's kind of transcendent. And it's unexpected. It sort of, the dumbness transforms ordinary situations and things into something that's sort of absurd and wonderful. And I didn't really find anything about Kong, the movie with the dragon and the bear. I did not find any of it particularly transcendent. I will say the only thing that's funny about it is the entire world telling the Italians to shove it. And I have to say that Rome has been getting it just really, Rome has been shafted in action movies lately, right? Like, it gets completely destroyed in the most recent Fast and Furious movie. It gets blown up a bunch in the latest Mission Impossible movie. And now Godzilla is sleeping in the Colosseum. So I feel bad for Rome. It's funny when people tell Italy to shove it. But nothing about this movie, like, nothing about it really made me laugh, right? It's just sort of dopey. It's okay. Like, it's sort of dopey. There's room for sort of dopey movies in the world. But I think I would have enjoyed the version of this movie that my kids thought was going to be presented for me more than the one I actually saw.
Yeah, no, I think that's all about right. I don't know. Peter, what did you make of Godzilla Kong New Empire?
Alyssa compares it to Anchorman, and Anchorman is kind of dumb, but Anchorman is dumb in a really smart way. And the thing about this movie is it's dumb in a really, really dumb way. It's just dumb, dumb. There's not like a genius behind it or a kind of cleverness. It's just idiocy all the way down. And there is something kind of amusing about that, that I appreciated. It really reminds me more than anything, except maybe the second and third Bay Transformers, which were smarter dumb in their own way, but which had a similar sort of like just incredible chaos vibe to them, where nothing needed to make sense and it was just big stuff happening and being thrown all over for a couple of hours. Really reminds me of, if you've ever asked a very young child who's like playing with a whole bunch of boys action figures in particular, just like given this sort of thing, but like a kid playing like a 5-year-old with in a sandbox with a whole bunch of toys, right? And like, it's not like, oh, I've got all the superheroes lined up. It's like, there's some Transformers and, you know, there's some dinosaurs and there's some trucks and there's some, right? And there's some sort of story in this kid's head that connects all of it. And they're just fighting, right? And they're just doing stuff. And they try to tell you, like, they're happy to just like spend like 45 minutes explaining to you why all these guys are fighting. Cause this one has a hat and he's so mad about the other one. It's a terrible hat. But he punched the other guy and then he got really mad. He was driving a big truck and the big truck came, right? And like, it just keeps going like that. And it makes just about that amount of sense. And some 5-year-olds are actually pretty smart about this stuff, but it has that sort of just like, did anyone think this through kind of childlike logic? And it's appealing in some ways on that level. I do think like it's not quite appealing enough. This is not a movie I really want to go back and watch a bunch more times. Certainly not like sitting in a theater or sitting and paying attention to it. But it is It is the kind of movie that I will probably turn on Sunday afternoons, like when I'm like kind of exhausted and want to take a nap on top of my dog, which I do sometimes. And in fact, the previous one, Godzilla versus Kong, which is also by Adam Wingard and really very similar in a lot of ways, except more Godzilla focused. So in this one, they fight a Kong doppelganger, right? An evil Kong. In the end of the previous one, they fight an evil Godzilla, right? It's very like the structure of the movies is very similar. They're just kind of negatives of each other. And I watched that one. I watched Godzilla versus Kong. Not like every week or anything, but with some frequency. And it
what?
And when I say watch it, I don't mean I turn it on and watch it. I mean, I turn it on and I go to sleep and like parts of it just kind of seep into my brain.
Like Sonny, I find this genuinely shocking. Do we even know you anymore?
Yeah. That's the weirdest thing. So I can deal with you saying that you've watched Reservoir Dogs 17,000 times or whatever.
Oh, but that one I've actually just like, I mean, I do watch that one sometimes while falling asleep, but that one I've like actually watched for
you
real.
You watch Reservoir Dogs while falling asleep?
It's not as good as
Seven for knocking me out, but yes.
I can understand a lot of your weird rewatches, but the idea of ever putting any of these movies on, I can even understand rewatching the first Godzilla, the 2014 Godzilla or whatever, whenever that came out, the one that Gareth Edwards directed. I could see rewatching that. I have rewatched it. I wouldn't necessarily do it all the time. It's at least kind of interesting formally and what some of the stuff he's doing in terms of showing Godzilla and all that. But the final third is
really pretty great. It's a beautiful third act. It's not a great movie, but it's often gorgeous to look at.
The idea of sitting down and rewatching either of these Godzilla versus Kong movies that's sickness. You need to be studied by a doctor.
So again, I want to say I don't sit down. I lay down on top of my dog. My boy dog likes to take naps with me on the weekends, and this is a thing we do sometimes on Sunday afternoons. It's like we go for a long walk in the morning, and then it's like kind of tired. And intentionally put on a trashy movie.
But you turn it on of your own volition. It's not like your television just flickers to life and like a Godzilla.
Because I'm looking for something that requires zero brain cells. I don't want something that I think that I have to think about. But here's the other thing one thing I want to compliment this movie on. I agree with Sonny that it looks kind of garbagey. Though I think it actually looks kind of garbagey on purpose. I think this is an aesthetic that the director has adopted and that there are fans of at this point, even though I do not in any way, I don't enjoy it. I don't think it looks all that good. But I've seen even people complimenting like, oh, there's so many textures on display, right? There's so many different colors, right? Because it's just a bunch of stuff like that. One thing this movie does really well, and the previous one also did really well, the sound design is actually really good. It's just pleasingly, awesomely loud. And that's true in the Alamo Drafthouse, and it's also true if you've got a big subwoofer that you can turn up and you can be surrounded by just like monsters booming. And I find that comforting. Like brainless monster stomping is what I want to take a nap to. And that is the best compliment I can give this movie, is that this is a great brainless monster stomping subwoofer movie that you can take a nap to with your very large dog who also enjoys this on a Sunday afternoon. And I will probably do that at least a couple of times in the next few years after this movie hits streaming.
I don't know if this podcast can recover from this revelation.
It's sick. That's sick behavior. You're.
It's a special class of rewatchable garbage film. There's other movies.
There's nothing special about this movie.
Yeah,
you can
do better.
So like I've watched the Len Wiseman Total Recall remake this way a number of times, even though there's the Arnold Schwarzenegger version that's sitting there and it's much better. But the Arnold Schwarzenegger version, I want to actually watch. I'm waiting for Kuatu to come out.
No, this is why you throw on like the Resident Evil movies or like the Underworld movies. Oh, maybe.
I totally agree. Both of those movies, both of those franchises, I should say, absolutely meet this criteria. Sometimes I watch Van Damme movies from the 90s. I don't even know what the names of them are. Like, I think one of them's called Double Team, but they're right. It's just like you kind of wake up after about an hour or something, and like he's like kicking somebody like through a door with a hammer knife. So
maybe if I had time to nap in the afternoons, I would understand this phenomenon. But Sonny, I think we have to end this podcast episode so we can do an intervention.
My dad used to do this while watching baseball. I don't watch sports, so I watch Godzilla.
Stop talking. All right, what do we think? Is it thumbs up or thumbs down on Godzilla Kong, the new empire? Oh, God, Peter.
Best sleep aid I've seen this year. Thumbs up.
Alyssa.
Thumbs down, and I'm gravely worried for the mental health of my podcast co-host.
Thumbs down. That's now I'm depressed, frankly. that whole bit. God. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our audio engineer, Jonathan Siri, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends a strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyMunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.